right, our second case for this morning is Stephen Cassell against David Snyders. Mr. Breen.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Keep your eye on the clock.
Yes, Your Honor. The plaintiffs this morning are asking the court to vacate the district court's decision and remand as to the 11th Amendment, RFRA, and due process. We would also ask, if the court is so inclined, to look again at Elam Romanian and overrule that case and apply what we would consider to be, what we would urge is a more appropriate standard under free exercise.
Do you agree that we would have to reverse Elam to come out in your favor?
Well, to totally come out in our favor, you would either have to reverse the mootness finding in Elam or the free exercise finding in Elam. But you still can come out for us as to the local defendants on the RFRA claim, because that is a very important point and one that we think the district court's decision causes grave injury to Illinois law and to the religious liberty rights of Illinoisans.
Let me get a break into one of my concerns, which is why, maybe, sorry, Judge.
Judge Hamilton.
The question is, why should a federal court decide this question, these questions under Illinois RFRA, given their novelty and the, frankly, difficult weighing that's required in the face of both legal and scientific uncertainty?
Well, and so this is part of the problem of the district court's decision. It both decided that the local officials enjoyed 11th Amendment immunity, which you believe is an incorrect statement of law just on its own, but then went through and made, if the 11th Amendment applies, a gratuitous ruling on RFRA in Illinois, again,
well,
on a novel point.
You asked the district court to decide the Illinois law questions, correct?
Well, and yes, Your Honor, because
the question is under 28 U.S.C. 1367, why should federal courts exercise discretionary jurisdiction to balance these difficult and competing factors under an Illinois statute that really hasn't been litigated very much, certainly not in these contexts?
Obviously, we are in a unique posture, Your Honor. What I would say is the reason to do it is we're certainly bound to bring it. We're bound to bring our claims, and the claims against the local officials are supplemental. They're part of the same core of facts. So I think we were bound to bring them as part of our complaint. Whether the district court wished to abstain in some way, I don't know that.
That's a complicated question when it comes to supplemental jurisdiction, but you certainly had the right to add them, and also then the court had the need to decide, as Judge Hamilton is saying, whether it wanted to exercise that supplemental jurisdiction or relinquish it. Obviously what the courts do is they'll dismiss without prejudice and let somebody move on in the state court.
And Your Honors, I would obviously,
and that's
the governor,
if you're right about the status of these various people as local defendants and not people who are being conscripted by the governor of Illinois to enforce state law, because once you get them over on the line of state defendants, then Pennhurst is in your way. Federal courts don't sit to tell state officers to comply with state law.
And certainly, Your Honor, the issues in the way the Seventh Circuit, as I understand it, has dealt with particularly Illinois law, Illinois sheriffs have been held to be agents of the state when they are doing something mandatory, like exercising when they serve it and execute a court order for which there is a specific statutory requirement in Illinois. You're under penalty of contempt. Otherwise, when you're looking at these, the various prescriptions of the executive orders of the governor, it's clear that the local officials have discretion whether to enforce or not.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I just remembered that I have a very fundamental question for you. We really are talking about a couple of things. We're talking about the governor's various orders, that were actually past number 70 at this point, But we're taking a look back into the past at an earlier generation of orders. But you're also trying to complain about the notice that the church was given to close down. And it's unclear to me, and I'd like your comment on it, whether any issues about this notice are now moot. Elam talks about whether the governor's executive order can be challenged, and since the governor's made it very clear he can ratchet up or ratchet down, he might reissue an order that looks exactly like the earlier one. But the notice strikes me as a different matter, and I'm not sure we have a live dispute about that.
Your Honors, we are in an odd posture because of Elam. You know, we had a motion for mootness, which the state agreed with back on, after the governor issued his order.
That's on the executive order side, but the notice's final paragraph says, if you do not adhere to this executive order, that was EO 2020-10. EO 2020-10 has evaporated at this point. So any future enforcement measures that would or would not be taken against the church would be under a different executive order. So I can understand adjudicating whether there can be a 10-person limit or that kind of thing, but I don't see how the local defendants have anything to do with this case other than by means of the role they played in serving the notice.
Well, and Your Honor, the you know, executive orders have been the one after the other, as you pointed out.
I know.
Right. And so at the time of Executive Order 10, certainly then there was 18 and 32 and others.
But did the church get more and more notices, or is this the only notice they ever got?
Well, that is the notice that was received by them and they closed down under. But the terms of the executive orders didn't change as
Oh, but
the
they did. So they were... I mean, some of the later executive orders, as you'll remember, had exceptions for free exercise of religion, as discussed in the Illinois Republican Party against Pritzker decision.
And the governor inserted those later provisions in response to the filing of this lawsuit.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying to you that this notice addressed restrictions on the church that were gone by the time Governor Pritzker perhaps agreed with your position and that of many others. I mean, this litigation is going on all over the country. And as you know, there was this later exemption for free exercise of religion that would let the church have 5,000 people in there if it really wanted to.
Right. Well, and one of the problems of this lawsuit is we are litigating as if Executive Order 32 were still in place. And so if
and
the church were to have...
I get that, but you're not answering my... Maybe I'm not being clear, but I'm focusing only on the local defendants.
Yes.
The local defendants, as I understand this record, are in this case only because they served the cease and desist order and the notice. And if I'm right that the notice is now ineffective, superseded, disappeared, then I don't see why we have any case against the local defendants. You would still have whatever you want to say about the governor, but I'm just focusing on that.
The sheriff and the health department have not disclaimed an interest in continuing to enforce whatever the governor's executive orders are on the church. So if we are at a place where the executive orders were arguing that it's not moot because the executive order could be reimposed, there's been no indication that the sheriff and the health department would back off. If anything, this, you know, the governor hasn't sent the state police.
But there is no cease and desist order in place right now, right?
Right, but there is certainly an intent shown. They've issued one before. You have to presume they'll issue more.
But we don't know what it would say. I mean, every time we wake up in the morning, we get more news about the pandemic, and we hear about a variety of variables that the public officials are working with. And so we don't know what any future cease and desist order would say.
And obviously we believe this issue was moot because the governor gave us a full exemption and took us out of the phases thing. So we don't believe there's going to be any more cease and desist orders at all.
So why can't we just get rid of the local defendants and simplify this case down to the case against Governor Pritzker?
if this case is not moot, so if the governor issued an executive order shutting down or reimposing Executive Order 32,
it's not terms, moot as to the executive order under Elam, unless we were
and Elam is
Elam.
Right. And Elam was wrong, both misapprehended the facts, and that led to a misapplication of the law on that point. And also then did not give the governor the benefit of the Hornbook law, that when a government official responds to litigation to give someone a full exemption, you give them the benefit of the doubt, which is what the governor did. We would give him the benefit of the doubt. Obviously, the Elam panel did not.
The Elam panel noted that the governor reserved the right to reimpose exactly the same or more stringent provisions if the scientific circumstances would merit it. So,
and Your Honor, yes, I don't know that that is accurate. And that, with all due deference to the panel, the governor imposed the phases on May 5th. On May 28th, after at least four lawsuits were filed against him, he entirely receded the field for free exercise of religion. He took away the mask requirement, the sanitizing, the social distancing, and all capacity restrictions from churches.
But in the last few days, he's been ratcheting things up because, of course, as you know, I mean, it's a little sad to read your brief and say, oh, only, you know, whatever it was, five people are dead in Stevenson County, and now it's 17, and the cases are skyrocketing, as they certainly are in nearby Rockford. The governor is clearly concerned that the state of Illinois may need to be under much more stringent controls.
And
maybe
Honor,
even including free exercise of religion. I don't know what he's going to do, but as Judge Hamilton said, he reserved the right to take whatever steps the science directed him to take.
And that's what the court noted in Elam.
And the court
Mr. Breen, can I ask you a different question? I'd like you to try to explain your due process claims, because it looks like what you're asking us to do is treat as a federal constitutional violation a failure to comply with procedures mandated by state statute.
And Your Honor, our argument is not that we don't want to federalize the Department of Public Health Act, but we do believe there is some requirement needed for notice and hearing pre-deprivation before you shut down the church.
Well, there's a long line of... As you may know, there's a long line of due process cases, federal constitutional due process cases, allowing for post-deprivation hearings when dealing with emergencies. Why would that not be sufficient?
And Your Honor, 8 months in, we're not in an emergency situation, and it was
I'm talking about an order that might take effect on a Thursday that would have an effect on Sunday services with a hearing in court or before an administrative body the following Tuesday.
And yet here, we don't have that opportunity under the governor's orders. So at least as applied by the local defendants with the cease and desist order, there was no opportunity to go to court. The opportunity to go to court would be to defend yourself against a misdemeanor citation.
And before we even get to the substance of your procedural due process claim, why haven't you forfeited that claim? I didn't see that claim in your complaint, and you don't mention it in your motion for preliminary injunction, which is what we're here for today.
It's in the motion at pages 13 and 14, and in the complaint, we have a count for a due process.
You have a
violation.
Substantive due process claim. I don't see a procedural due process claim in your complaint.
Well, and Your Honor, I guess we had understood it to be a procedural due process more than substantive. But again, the record will reflect. I don't want to disagree,
so
Your Honor.
So it's your position
was
from a procedural due process point of view that the governor has to provide a pre-deprivation hearing for every citizen and every church and every organization in the state of Illinois before issuing a stay-at-home order?
Well, at least in this circumstance where we were a month and a half
I'm saying how this we don't sit to decide only one person's principle. If the principle is there has to be a pre-deprivation hearing, there are restaurants, there are hotels, there are airline companies, there are individual people, there are sole proprietors, and I take it your position is they all have to have a pre-deprivation hearing for Judge Hamilton's Thursday order that affects Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. That's a lot of hearings around the state of Illinois.
And Your Honor, that is provided, though, under the Department of Public Health Act. And
if so it's that a is, shutdown, but of course, you're dealing with a case where up to 10 or less than 10 people, so 9 people could get together. Why is that a shutdown?
Well, and Your Honor, in this particular case where you've got a congregation of 10 to 15 families, they can't get together. The pastor's own family can't go to church.
10 of them can. Why is that a shutdown if they can assemble in smaller groups? We talked about that in Elam as well, of course.
And in this particular case, you're looking at trying to assign, you're placing a value saying that if you get 5 or 10, that's enough. That, we respectfully contend, is not the law when you're looking at
Jacobson says that courts are in a very bad position to micromanage numbers like that, as did the Chief Justice.
I understand where the Chief Justice was on that. At the same time, in South Bay, California had a 100-person or 25% capacity limit on the facts. As well, here we do have, you know, we've been pressing the Illinois RFRA, which takes you to the compelling interest and least restrictive means analysis. And other than the district court decision in this case, we know of no other case where another court has held that a 10-person hard cap can stand up to strict scrutiny, especially when you're up against factories making, you know, pork rinds down the street, or so the tire factory down the street after that.
Breen, on that point, this circles back to one of my earlier concerns. How does one apply the least restrictive means test in the face of just fundamental scientific uncertainty about public health? It seems to me that when we're talking about a risk of lethal infections that spread far beyond the particular individuals who might attend the church, it seems like you're asking us to apply the Illinois RFRA statute in such a way so as to say this congregation is entitled to choose not only to take health risks for themselves, but also to impose those risks on their communities. How do we balance that under a least restrictive means test?
Your Honor, we're asking you to compare it to other, you know, other factors in the community, use the test as it was set out and has been repeated. In this particular case, you've got the Snack King down the street, hundreds of people together 5 days a week, 8 to 12 hours a day, making pork rinds, fried pork rinds. You've got the Kelly Tire Factory where they're stacked up at clock in, clock out. We're just asking for equal treatment under that point. And what those exceptions certainly do is they undermine the compelling interest in holding the beloved church right at 10 people when they want to bring 10 to 15 family units together. With plenty of social distancing, masking, and all of that, it undermines the compelling interest and then makes the least restrictive means the one that has been chosen and has been adhered to by the people of Illinois, thousands of congregations for the last 5.5 months. So that's all we're asking, you just apply the test that has been out there for quite some time. And I do see my time is running short. I want to answer all the questions.
If you would like to reserve, I don't know if anybody has questions, but sure, we'll let you save the rest.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, so Ms. Gupta, are you starting?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Priyanka Gupta for Defendant Governor Pritzker. I'll be answering all common questions for the defendants, and then my colleague, Benjamin Jacoby, will present arguments specifically on behalf of local defendants Bentima and Snyders. This court has made clear that a preliminary injunction is an exceptional remedy, only to be granted in cases that clearly demand it. This case does not. Plaintiffs conceded in their reply brief that the acute exigencies of this request have been eliminated. Yet they asked this court to preliminarily enjoin a limit that was imposed to slow the spread of COVID-19 and that has not been in effect since May. They are not entitled to this extraordinary relief. To begin, plaintiffs have not carried their significant burden to show a likelihood of success on the merits. My friend from the other side just recognized that Elim applies to their free exercise claim, and so under this court's controlling precedent, they cannot succeed on the merits of their free exercise claim. That brings us to their next federal claim, which they claim is a federal due process claim. Judge St. Eve, I would agree with what your question indicated, which is that that claim was actually forfeited. At paragraph 121 of the plaintiff's complaint, they say that they are the enforcement of the executive orders violate, and I quote, plaintiff's substantive due process rights secured by the 14th Amendment. So there is no question that their complaint was bringing a substantive due process claim. But even if this court were to reach that forfeited argument, it is well settled that a failure to adhere to state procedures does not on its own amount to a federal due process violation. Now, we don't think any state procedures were violated here because the church was not closed off and made off limits as contemplated by the Illinois Department of Public Health Act. And so these procedural safeguards were not triggered.
What about the effect of the notice, which did seem to say that because it wasn't abiding by the executive order, the church might be closed down, at least that the Department of Public Health had the authority to order closure and that such an order might issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the key point is that that notice said that such an order might issue, and that order specifically said that the process for such an order issuing is set out in the statute, the same provision of the statute that plaintiffs point to in saying that they're entitled to procedural safeguards. So the notice itself recognized the procedures in place for closing off their church, but that next step was not taken here.
So you're saying so in your view, the notice was just, in a sense, an alert. It wasn't an act of closure in and of itself.
Yes, Your Honor. It was simply putting plaintiffs on notice or on alert that the church could be closed off and that that order would actually come from the Illinois Department of Public Health and it would be subject to the process set out in the relevant statute. So if that were to occur, those safeguards would have been triggered. Here, that was not the case. Although, again, even if the safeguards should have been applied here, which we think they should not, this court has made clear that simply a failure to follow state procedures does not amount to a due process violation. And plaintiffs here, even now at argument, have not been able to argue that, point out why the due process clause required anything more. And so even accepting this forfeited federal due process argument, plaintiffs have not even been able to state a claim under the federal due process clause. And this court pointed out in the Illinois Republican Party against Pritzker case that plaintiffs must make a strong showing on the likelihood success of the merits. At the very least, this requires a demonstration of how they're going to prove the key elements of their claim. Here, they are not even able to make this initial threshold showing as to their federal due process claim. And therefore, they are not entitled to preliminary injunctive relief based upon that federal claim.
Ms. Gupta, can you address the merits of the Illinois Religious Freedom Restoration Act claim? As I've got to say, it's when Illinois adopts a least restrictive means test and then doesn't have a little more flexibility in the order than the one that was challenged has. Seems like there's a problem there. Why is the limit 10 instead of 11 or 12 or 20? Why isn't there some adjustment for the size of the space involved and so on?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd first note that the deference echoed in Jacobson, the Chief Justice concurrences, and the cases on which the Chief Justice relied make clear that in public health emergencies, all rights, including a statutory right to the free exercise of religion, are subject to reasonable restrictions to protect the public health and safety.
That may make perfect sense as a matter of First Amendment law and as applied in, for example, Elam. But we have a state statute that uses considerably broader language. Most of us are used to applying strict scrutiny in a variety of contexts, and it's pretty tough to satisfy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Take the tire factory and pork rind factories that your friend on the other side mentioned, for example.
Yes, Your Honor. My friend on the other side seems to have anecdotal evidence of a pork rind factory. I would note that EO 32 did place restrictions on manufacturing. It asked that only essential lines be operated and that shifts be staggered to minimize the risk of transmitting COVID-19. So EO32 did not allow the type of situation my friend on the other side is describing, but setting that to one side, even if this court were to apply strict scrutiny under the Illinois RFRA and to delve into this novel state law claim, we believe strict scrutiny would be satisfied. At the first step, the substantial harm step, plaintiffs carry the burden of showing substantial harm, and we are not asking this court to judge the sincerity of their beliefs. But all they've pled is that in-person services are essential. And both the cease and desist notice and EO 32 allow them to have smaller in-person gatherings.
Well, I don't think that's a very strong foundation for your argument. Why don't you, I think you ought to move on to the merits, because
yes,
prohibiting a full congregation from meeting is a pretty substantial burden on any church or religious group, however well justified it may be. And as I say, as a member of the Elam panel, I thought those were justified, but I don't think the substantial burden element is where you ought to focus your attention.
Yes, Your Honor. Even assuming a substantial burden, the state has shown a compelling interest in protecting the public health and safety from the spread of this virus, which can have serious and even deadly effects. Plaintiffs claim that there is no compelling interest as to them because only 6 people have died and there have only been 530-some cases. But as Judge Wood noted, the number of deaths have increased in that county and the number of cases have skyrocketed as well. So there is still a compelling interest in preventing the spread of COVID-19 that is in that county. I would also add that in the EO62, which plaintiffs cited as supplemental authority, Region 1, where Stevenson County is located, has now been subject to a second round of mitigation measures because the situation is so severe. And so it's simply inaccurate to say that COVID-19 does not pose a threat in Stevenson County. And so the state and the local defendants do maintain a compelling interest. Moving on to the least restrictive alternative, as Your Honor pointed out, when in discussing this issue with my friend from the other side, there is a lot of scientific uncertainty that still surrounds COVID-19. But what we knew when the limit was imposed and what we still know about the virus is that it does spread easily in close quarters where people are gathered for extended periods of time and engaging in activities that lead to respiratory transmission, such as speaking and praying. And while masks and hand sanitizing are very critical in our fight against COVID-19, and they certainly go a long way in helping us along that fight, they're not foolproof. There is a reason that this argument is happening over Zoom and in person. Hand sanitizing and wearing masks is simply not as safe as reducing the number of people who gather in one room. And Your Honor, this court recognized in Elam that many epidemiologists have recommended limiting the size of gatherings and that the 10-person limit specifically comes from CDC health guidance. So given the scientific information that we did have about this limit and the information that we still have now, limiting gatherings such as religious services that increase the risk of COVID-19 transmission is the least restrictive means of preventing the spread of this virus. And so we...
So what do you say, though, this came up in Elam as well, but you may have a congregation of 100 that meets in a 3,000 square foot room. You could have a cathedral with a 30,000 square foot nave, and it's still a 10-person limit, right? How does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor, because even though a larger building will, of course, help reduce the risk of COVID-19, and I don't believe the record is developed on this point at this stage, but the science does show that because these particles can linger in the air after people have gathered for more than 30 minutes and have been singing and speaking, anyone who moves through those areas can risk getting COVID-19. And here we don't have a cathedral. We have a small church that plaintiffs do say they can socially distance in, but it is certainly not of the size that Your Honor suggests. And plaintiffs also say that a central religious right is the ability to converse with each other around the church and its building after services are completed. And that type of activity also increases the risk of spreading COVID-19. So given that the facts that we have here and that it's inherently more dangerous to have more people in a building, the 10-person limit was still the least restrictive limit for preventing the spread of this virus.
So how important, as we think of this least restrictive means point, is it that the members of the church are not internalizing risks to themselves when they meet, but in fact there are significant externalities to these risks, since somebody who goes to the church and says, well, I'm willing to assume whatever residual risk there is because my religion means a great deal to me. You know, I have to assume that's true for everybody who's in the church. But then they go home, you know, and they go to the grocery store or they go to Home Depot or they go someplace and they breathe on someone. And now that person gets COVID-19, not a member of the church, not somebody who shares those views. So is the governor relying at all on that sort of second level externality in saying, you know, as he picks a number, he needs some discretion to choose it? Because of course we can always play the game, well, if you can have 10 people, why not 11? You know, if 11, why not 12? How do we answer that under least restrictive means lens?
Your Honor, I think the externalities here absolutely do inform the least restrictive means analysis. And that's because this court is looking to what means would accomplish the compelling interest. And the compelling interest here is to protect the society as a whole. And the society as a whole is vulnerable when people make the decision to meet. They are not just putting their own life, exposing themselves to the virus. They are, as Your Honor explained, exposing others in the community to the virus. And so in determining what type of measures are necessary to protect the public at large, it matters that this virus can spread so easily from person to person. And so that certainly also goes to show why this was the least restrictive means necessary here.
Isn't that also very relevant to the balancing of the hardships for the preliminary injunction?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd first note that plaintiffs do not bring up the balancing of the hardships at all in their opening brief and seem to have forfeited any such argument, but also even if plaintiffs were willing to expose themselves to this virus, they cannot say that the community as a whole is being willing to be exposed to this virus simply so that they can exercise their religious rights. So the balance of the hardships and the public interest still tips in favor of not granting this preliminary injunction. I'd also like to know, and perhaps my friend on the other side can clarify, that in the reply brief, plaintiffs at page 2 seem to be asking for a full evidentiary hearing or a trial on the merits. And then at page 20, they ask for this case to be remanded for a permanent injunction. So it's not clear to me in the reply brief that they have shown the exigency needed for a preliminary injunction, given that they are asking for this more full-fledged relief. And of course, those claims are still before the district court and plaintiffs are free to pursue them there.
And if finally, you'd like to save anything for Mr. Jacoby, this might be a good time.
Yes, Your Honor. I will yield my time to Mr. Jacoby.
Thank you. Mr. Jacoby.
Thank you. May it please the court. I represent Stephenson County Sheriff Snyders and Stephenson County Health Department Administrator Bentima. And I want to focus my comments directly to Judge Wood's inquiry on the mootness of the cease and desist notice. The cease and desist notice does reference the executive order 10 at the time, would have been an EO 10 at the time, which of course has long expired. But I'll take it one step further. The health department, the county health department, never had the authority and doesn't have the authority to enforce an executive order anyway. The county health department's authority is delegated to it from the Illinois Department of Public Health pursuant to the IDPH's regulations. And its authority is limited to that of the IDPH Act. And the IDPH Act allows the county health department to seek a closure order from a court upon a clear and convincing showing of evidence, but that's all it's allowed to do. It does
so
have.
So you're saying this notice was just a heads up then? It wasn't a concrete detriment?
100%. It was not an order for closure from a court. It was not an order for immediate closure, which would be the only other option, and which only lasts 48 hours under the IDPH Act. It did not close the court. It did not close the church, and it did not tell the church that the church was closed. In fact, it only references the church to the IDPH Act, Section 2B, which is the power to close, and Section 2C, which is the procedure to close. So those are the only things that this notice, it was a heads up, it was an alert, however you want to say it, that's all it did. And it could not have closed the church under the executive order because the county health department doesn't have the authority to enforce the executive order. Its only authority is limited to that delegated to it under the Illinois Department of Health Act. And so that's an alternative basis for these local defendants for this court to affirm the denial of the preliminary injunction as to these local defendants and as to Stevenson County defendants in particular. And with that, I think my argument is concluded. So unless this court has any questions.
All right, I see none. So thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Breen?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, on the local, the cease and desist notice at the bottom last sentence, in addition to such an order of closure issued by the Illinois Department of Public Health, you may be subject to additional civil and criminal penalties. And I think it's well known that you've had citations, and there's a criminal penalty attached to the violations of the Department of Public Health Act, is what I understand. And certainly a notice like this would cause a reasonable individual to look at it and believe they are having this enforced against them, not that it was a preliminary step.
But obviously, it just says maybe. It doesn't say you have done anything. And if there were a criminal penalty, I presume there would be full due process associated with it.
After you've been arrested.
I would think that warning is enough to let you go into federal court, at least in the first instance. But the problems posed here are more from the frequent changes of the executive order requirements. So
I would tend to agree with you, Judge Hamilton. And I do want to make clear, Your Honor, Judge Hamilton noted the Elam decision, stated very specifically, warehouses, meatpacking, nursing homes, and all of that may have a similar spread risk as churches. And so even though the Elam panel did not see that was relevant to the free exercise determination, it would be relevant under a RFRA analysis where the defendants bear the burden of proving the compelling interest test and the least restrictive means.
If with my colleague's indulgence, I guess, let me just ask you one more time, Mr. Breen, to address this problem of whether we frame it as externalities or putting risks on others, how that should come into the calculation in a least restrictive means test being applied under state law. That just seems to me like just a very, very difficult policy problem.
It is, and the reason you need to anchor it with the other risks in the community. So you look at the exceptions undermining the compelling interest in shutting down this particular church or limiting this particular church to 10 people, and which is why we recited Snack King in our complaint, in the declaration with our reply. We cited the Kelly Tire facility. Obviously, Elam has noted the nursing homes and the other risks of meatpacking plants in the community. We would say you've got to take those into account. The burden is on the defendants, though, to prove this, not us. So it's on the defendants, and they certainly did not even attempt to show the difference in risk between those settings and a church with proper social distancing, et cetera.
Okay. Anything further, Judge Hamilton?
No, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, Judge St. Eve?
No, thank you.
All right, well then, our thanks to both counsel, and the court will take this, or all counsel, actually, there are three of you, and the court will take this case under advisement.